From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, food stamp cuts are looming for some Michigan families.
It's definitely going to have a significant impact.
Changing the way our kids learn history. It's the Big History Project.
All through the course, we ask the students to analyze where people are getting their claims, including the scholars who are lecturing them.
Living in the UP means driving 60 miles one way to get to a well-stocked grocery store. We look at food insecurity in the UP.
The UP has lagged behind the rest of the country in terms of economic recovery. I mean, there's still areas of the UP that have nearly 20% unemployment.
And a judge rules Detroit can keep turning off water to delinquent customers. Those stories and more today on Stateside. Food insecurity. We hear a lot about Detroit, Flint, cities battling poverty and food insecurity. But there's another region where access to healthy, fresh food is a constant challenge, the Upper Peninsula.
The UP has lagged behind the rest of the country in terms of economic recovery. I mean, there's still areas of the UP that have nearly 20% unemployment.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, fighting hunger in the Upper Peninsula. But first, water shutoffs to Detroiters who haven't paid their bills are not going to stop. That's the result of a ruling today by federal bankruptcy judge Stephen Rhodes. Michigan Radio's Detroit reporter Sarah Swick is with us now. Sarah, this ruling came in response to a lawsuit filed by Detroit residents and activists. What did they want Judge Rhodes to do?
They wanted Judge Rhodes to issue a six-month moratorium on the process of shutting off water to residences in the city of Detroit to people who are behind on their bills more than $150. They said that the ongoing shutoff campaign, which has escalated this year and really in the past year, is inhumane and that it affects the poor and that people have a basic fundamental right to water.
And why won't he do it?
A couple of reasons. The first is that, interestingly, after hearing a couple days of arguments on this case, which is obviously tied up with Detroit's bankruptcy case, Judge Rhodes said he didn't really think he had the authority to do it, to order the water department to stop these shutoffs. Secondly, though, he, you know, shot down most of the arguments that the plaintiff's attorneys made, saying that people don't actually have a right to, not to free water, but he said to affordable water, which basically is what the plaintiffs had been asking for, was for the city to institute a more flexible affordability plan so people can pay for water based on what they can afford to pay based on their income. And Judge Rhodes said that he also didn't want to jeopardize the water department's revenues, that basically that by stepping up the shutoff campaign, the department had increased its revenues, increased collection, and that that could all be jeopardized if they were to stop the shutoffs, even temporarily, and that it would also perhaps give people incentive to delay or continue not paying their bills.
So he says, A, I don't have the power, and B, I don't support this idea anyway. Where does this leave residents and activists who want to end these shutoffs?
Well, the plaintiffs in this particular case have said they intend to appeal. They think that there are valid constitutional claims here in terms of due process rights being violated, and they also say the Michigan Constitution guarantees certain minimal levels of sanitary service and that this violates that. But it doesn't leave them with too many more options legally, but there are still ongoing efforts sort of on the more grassroots level to help people out when they do get their water shut off and to arrange for, you know, to get people connected to assistance funds and other things of that nature.
Well, Sarah, it is worth noting that more than half the households in Detroit are at or below 150% of the federal poverty level, and the city created that nonprofit fund to accept donations for those who need it. How is that doing?
The fund so far, I mean, it's been accumulating funds from some pretty big-name corporate donors. City officials have said that the long-term plan is when this new Great Lakes Regional Water Authority comes into play that there will be a water assistance fund that is based on a percentage of the authority's revenues, and that will be available to everyone the Detroit Water Department serves. So there are plans in place to provide additional assistance funds to people who genuinely can't afford to pay, but it's something that is supposed to accumulate over time.
So that basic question of the affordability of water to Detroiters is not going to be addressed, at least not by the federal bankruptcy judge.
No, the basic question of affordability, I mean, we have in this Great Lakes Water Authority plan, they have promised to cap rates going up at a maximum of 4% a year, but, you know, going out over a decade, that's more than 40% higher than rates that are already pretty high. So in terms of that core question of water being made more affordable to people, it seems that the answer so far they've come up with is there needs to be more, just more assistance funds in place for people who can afford to pay rather than addressing the rate question.
Michigan Radio, Sarah Swick. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Tens of thousands of Michigan families will soon see their food stamp benefits trimmed. The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, known as SNAP, was scaled back in the new Farm Bill. And Michigan is one of only four states not doing something to avoid these cuts. NLive's Jonathan Osting joins us now. Jonathan, take us back to last February. This Farm Bill was signed. Just what did it do to SNAP benefits?
Sure. Well, the debate actually goes back further than February. Republicans were sort of bargaining through that Farm Bill process to scale back the food stamp program in some capacity. And the ultimate solution they arrived at was largely dependent on closing what they called a loophole in the food stamp program known as Heat and Eat. It allowed states to, well, essentially recipients can receive extra food stamps if they also can show that they needed assistance with heating bills. Well, this loophole that Republicans talked about allowed states to provide just like a dollar of assistance to recipients and therefore allow them to qualify for these extra food stamps. So Republicans said that shouldn't have existed in the first place, and that's sort of the cut they arrived at. They said the federal government would end up saving a lot of money by closing this loophole.
Now, Michigan is one of only four states that isn't taking action to avoid these cuts. How is that working?
Well, Michigan was one of 16 states that had been sort of taking advantage of this heat and eat option to provide extra assistance, but it's only one of four that hasn't decided a way to continue doing so. So the Republicans in Congress, to close this loophole, essentially required that states can no longer provide only $1 of assistance for heating. They have to provide at least $21 of heating assistance. 12 states have decided to go ahead and pay that $21. Some of them are simply using more federal assistance from another heating program. California, in one case, has actually devoted some of its own general fund dollars to essentially protect its recipients from cuts.
And Michigan isn't doing so because?
Michigan isn't doing so because it believes that you know, there are people who legitimately need heating assistance, and they don't want to take any dollars away from those people by shifting those dollars to the Heat and Eat program. So the state does currently provide assistance for people, especially in the winter, to help them avoid shutoffs for utility bills, and the state didn't want to redirect any of those monies. Now, it could have certainly prioritized some general fund spending, but lawmakers did not take that step.
And I'm sure critics have something to say about that. I know you spoke with Gilda Jacobs with the Michigan League for Public Policy. What are critics saying?
Yeah, well, critics are saying, you know, it's a missed opportunity. Even if you want to continue to call it a loophole, the state could have spent just a few dollars per recipient to ensure that they would not lose a much larger amount in assistance. So the numbers that the Michigan League for Public Policy cited, they claim that $8 million in payments for the state could have helped bring about $250 million in additional federal food benefits to Michigan families.
Jonathan, there are some opponents of using this loophole who claim that cutting SNAP back somewhat, it's a way of installing a mentality of self-reliance and responsibility into people. What's being made of this argument?
Yeah, sure. Well, I talked to State Senator Bruce Caswell who sort of was instrumental in reworking the heating assistance program. What he essentially said is that if the federal government wants to provide more food stamps, that should be a separate conversation. He didn't come out and say, you know, he necessarily agrees with scaling back the program. It didn't weigh in one way or another. But he said what he didn't want to do was go the route that other states have done, which is taking some more of those heating assistance dollars and providing them to people who didn't actually need it. So that $1 the state previously gave to recipients was for, you know, food stamp recipients who maybe lived in an apartment building where all their utilities were covered already. So if the state provided $21 to those people, that would be the same recipients who actually didn't have utility bills, but it was a way for the state to help them access extra food benefits.
What are groups who work with the poor saying about the impact that this trimming back will have once it kicks in full force in November?
Well, they're saying it's going to be a very real impact. I mean, Michigan already struggles with a high poverty rate, and a large percentage of those people who fall below the poverty line currently or live in households that fall below the poverty line are children. So it's definitely going to have a significant impact, and groups are trying to find ways to supplement them with other community support systems.
MLive reporter Jonathan Osting filling us in on the upcoming food stamp cuts that are coming in Michigan, as we are one of four states not taking action to avoid them. His story is found on MLive.com. As always, thank you so much, Jonathan.
Hey, thanks, Cindy. Appreciate it.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you had a typical American high school experience, chances are pretty good you trudged through the day going from one period to another. Maybe you started with algebra, then to American Lit, then chemistry, on to history, and so on. One class after the other. And perhaps you paid the most attention to gym or to the clock on the wall. History in particular gets a bum rap with grumbling about having to memorize dates and names. What's missing? A sense of all of this knowledge being connected. Enter the Big History Project. Microsoft billionaire Bill Gates has become a champion of this new way to teach history, and he's pumping his own money into plans to develop this new history curriculum for high schools. My next guest is one of the advisors to Bill Gates and the Big History Project. Bob Bain is a professor of history and education at the University of Michigan. Why is a new history curriculum like the Big History Project something that you feel is worth your effort, something that needs to be offered to our high schoolers?
So I'll tell you, the first thing, before coming to the University of Michigan, I was a high school history teacher and social studies teacher for 26 years. Over that time, I faced a number of what I would call enduring problems in American education. One you just articulated, the curriculum is in pieces. So most kids experience school as one thing after another. Secondly, many, many of our students are disengaged. The federal government claims that 40% of American high school students are chronically disengaged. And the third thing was that I was really kind of troubled by the fact that most learning was didactic. The kids were listening to other people. They were memorizing other people's answers. This course and this approach to history actually gave us leverage on all three of those major problems.
So explain, what is the Big History Project?
So Big History is a course that was invented by a professor at Macquarie University, David Christian, where he wondered, could I create a course, a world history course, that actually begins with the beginning, with the Big Bang? His colleagues thought he was crazy. How could you possibly cover 13.8 billion years of time in one course? So David took up the challenge. And what he did was he invited in a number of professors from different departments, the astronomy department, the chemistry department, the anthropology department, and slowly they created this course. David then heard a narrative in it. And so then he began to teach it on his own, wrote a book on it. And the backstory on the project is Bill Gates, when he jogs on his treadmill, apparently watches teaching company videos. And he saw David's Big History course and fell in love with it. Thought this was a course that where all things were connected. He thought it was an on-ramp for the other history courses, but more importantly, math and science courses. And so that's how the Big History Project got funded. And that's what we've been doing. We've been creating a free online course to be taught in high schools literally around the globe.
Help us understand how in a course you cover some 14 billion years of history. And I'm sure you answered that question initially right out of the gate.
So what David Christian did was he constructed a large narrative, a narrative that actually our kids question. But the narrative is built around 8 major turning points in the history of the universe and human history. These turning points are what he calls our thresholds of increasing complexity, places where the universe or human history just became more interesting because they became more complex, also more fragile. So like all good history stories, this one hangs around major events. So it actually ends up being quite coherent. And the only details you study are the ones that actually help move the story forward or challenge it. So it actually our students actually come away understanding an awful lot of content, capable of doing really good inquiry, and they find the course hangs together.
What are they coming away skill-wise with that they would not have had if they had not taken the big history?
There's two things. Mm-hmm. One is they come away with an understanding of the ways in which things are connected, and that's a skill. And so they encounter the way the chemist, for example, helps us answer big questions about how we arrived here, or they understand the way the anthropologist does. So that's one skill. But the other thing is that we've built into this course what we call investigations and problem-based learning. There's 10 of these. Students take up really big questions that are of interest to them, and then they read and write around historical texts, scientific texts, to produce arguments and narratives and explanations. Therefore, this course really presses hard on improving the capacity for kids to read and write the kinds of things that actually, frankly, good citizens should be reading and writing.
Critical thinking.
The capacity to analyze claims that other people are making.
I'm speaking with University of Michigan History and Education Professor Bob Bain, who's an advisor to a new way of teaching history, Big History. And the Big History Project has become a top priority for billionaire Bill Gates. How many schools in Michigan, Bob, are using Big History?
We've got 15 schools currently active teaching it. We had last year, I think, 20. This has been teacher dependent. So when a teacher leaves the program, often a school will wait a year or two before readopting it. By the way, it's a pilot.
It's a pilot.
So this is the other thing that's been this is my 43rd year in public education, and I've never participated in any kind of educational experience where we have gone so slowly to learn how to do this correctly. The first year, we only had 6 schools in the United States, or 5 schools actually, excuse me, and 7 teachers. And we worked really closely with them. We studied what they were doing. And then we overhauled the course the second year based on what we were learning from teachers in suburban districts, independent schools, and urban districts. Then we did it again year 2 and done it again year 3. Now we're rolling it out wider.
And what do you hear from teachers? Is it something teachers are open to, or is there resistance? What kind of sales job do you have to do?
Actually, people are coming to us. It's one of the easiest educational sells I've ever had to make for a couple of reasons. One is they're interested in the kinds of questions we're raising. Second, this is a course that provides unbelievable support for teachers. I started teaching history in 1972. Most of my training was in U.S. history. I was assigned world history courses. Now, I couldn't admit to my principal that I actually didn't know all that stuff, but I didn't. Teachers have no problem saying, you know what, I don't know the science piece of this, or I don't know the history piece of it. So what we've done is we've surrounded them with support. We call it actually a just-in-time professional development. So our teachers log on to the site to teach their students, and they encounter little videos on how to teach content. They have exchange with other teachers. We've hired some master teachers to support them. So if you were a teacher beginning to teach this course, and on Sunday night you were planning out what you're going to do for the week, you could go on to line and contact any one of a number of people. How about this one? We have a 24-hour helpline. So any teacher that's interested in any question that they have, they can send an email to us. It goes to a number of people. And within 24 hours, usually within an hour, they get an answer.
So the support is there. I got to wonder what you're hearing from folks who feel queasy at having billionaire Bill Gates, who is now a philanthropist, backing this, saying, I think we need this for our schools. He's not an educator. I know he's brought in educators, but is there some queasiness, particularly people who don't feel his support for Common Core?
Of course. John Dewey once said that all education is political. And so certainly there are politics around this. What we say to people is take a look at the course. If it was the Michigan Department of Ed creating this course, would you be interested in it? And people who actually take a look at what we're doing have been pretty attracted to it. So we've actually not had any problems with anyone who actually takes a look at what we're doing. You pointed out that educators and historians created this course. So I'm a PhD historian. As I told you, I've taught for 43 years. My research is all on teaching and learning. David Christian is a PhD historian at Macquarie. There's a virtual faculty. There must be 30 mini lectures given in this course. So our students are actually being taught by some of the leading scholars in the world. And all this, by the way, is for free. So the moment you get beyond that question and take a look at what we're doing, it's been pretty attractive.
Is it a one-year curriculum? Does it run over the 4 years? What's the structure?
So you name it, and we've had schools who've tried it. So that's the virtue of doing a pilot. So, for example, we had a school, Brooklyn Latin, decided they were going to run this course as a five-week intensive over the summer at NYU Library. Worked incredibly successfully. We have schools that are teaching it over a course of a year to ninth graders. We have schools that are teaching it in a semester. We have schools that are team teaching it with a science teacher and a history teacher. And we have some middle schools.
So it's very adaptable to whatever the school feels.
It's incredibly flexible.
And you're going in individually to schools, aren't you, as opposed to trying to sell it to the whole idea to an entire district?
Well, we have some districts that are interested. And so, you know, we're in a place now after 3 years of piloting this where we're comfortable to say that, you know, this actually can be successful in under-resourced schools and urban districts, can be successful in an independent school. So we're far more comfortable because we actually have a track record now with schools in a wide range of places.
What does success look like in your mind with this course?
A couple things, and we track this. So one is that the teachers feel well supported, well engaged, and they like the content that we're providing. We ask our teachers to analyze every single asset, every single lesson, and we track on it so that we know if teachers are giving us bad feedback on something, either it needs to be improved or dropped. And so that's what we do. A small example, the first year of this course, we had 20 units. Our seven pilot teachers said, far too many. It's breaking the content up. And so at no small expense in both in time and money, we reduced it down to 10 units covering the same content but much more coherently. Secondly, we monitor what students are learning. So we are assessing them on nationally normed tests to look to see are they learning the historical content, the physics content, you know, to a strong degree. And we're seeing growth in that. And then we're also measuring their literacy. Are they improving in their ability to use evidence when they make an argument, to read and write, to test claims? And then finally, we do a baseline, midterm, and end of course, asking them, are they engaged? We ask questions, does this course help explain complicated things to you in multiple ways? There's some evidence that if someone answers that yes, it correlates really strongly with achievement. And blessedly, we're finding that for the most part, our students, they like the course and it's working. However, we do see a drop-off. We've noticed that as we continue to scale this up, some of the engagement numbers are not as high as we had initially, and so we're backtracking.
What do you think is behind that?
Probably a couple of things. As more and more schools are offering this requiring for every student, we are seeing a drop-off. The other thing is as teachers get more experienced with teaching it, they become more comfortable. We're still running by far and away higher than most other courses, but even the slight drop has got us concerned. So we're tracking.
Work in progress. Mm-hmm. What are your hopes for what this course might do in the minds of these youngsters taking it and going on to college and beyond?
Probably the most important thing is that they'll be able to be aware of where the information that they're consuming is coming from, and they develop a critical sensibility. We have characters in the course called claim testers. We teach our students that human beings can support claims. This is in the first unit, by the way. Support claims by intuition, logic, authority, and empirical evidence. And then all through the course, we ask the students to analyze where people are getting their claims, including the scholars who are lecturing them, David Christian or myself in the lectures, and all the reading they're doing. So I think that's a pretty important thing for citizens in a democracy to be able to do. So that's a great hope. Secondly, we have some confidence that this is opening up students' understanding to what science and history, the meaning it could have in their own personal lives, because all of this is connecting them to these academic disciplines. We also have people giving lectures, for example, that say why they're interested in cosmology. So Tim McKay gives a lovely lecture about why he's interested in cosmology. And these are the questions that the next generation of cosmologists are going to take up.
Planting seeds.
And so we're hoping that we're inviting in students to join us in this great adventure.
Going forward, do you envision this continuing to be free of charge to schools that want it?
Our promise is that it will always be free of charge. And the commitment by Mr. Gates and BGC3, which is his office that's funding it, is we want this to work in the most under-resourced schools. So we have urban schools that couldn't afford textbooks, yet they're getting very high-quality material from us. And so the commitment is, yep, it's going to be free in perpetuity.
You can find out more about the Big History Project at their website, bighistoryproject.com. It's open to anyone to check out. There's even a sample, there's videos that kind of give folks a sense of what's covered, isn't
and
it?
Actually, any teacher could log on to it. We've got, for example, over 1,000 people that are teaching the course that they're not part of our design partners. We've got 200 design partners, classrooms all across the country that are helping us improve the course. But there's another 1,000 classrooms all across the world that are teaching this course because they found it, and we give access to them for free.
Bob Bain, University of Michigan History and Education Professor and advisor to the Big History Project. Thank you so much, Bob. It was great talking with
you. Thanks very much. I enjoyed it.
For 7 years, the football team at Detroit's Cody High School never had a home game. Their own field was in such miserable shape they had to play on other teams' fields. That changed Friday night. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reports on the Cody Comets' first game on their new field, fittingly named Hope Field.
High school football fields don't get much better than this. The virgin AstroTurf is all springy under your feet, and the neon yellow goalposts stretch up into the blue September sky. The Comets should be playing well. They're not.
Hey, back up, back up, back up! Back up!
At halftime, the score is 0-0 against arch rival Henry Ford. And this year, the Comets are supposed to be a much better team. Coach Calvin Norman tells his assistant coaches, don't blame the players.
We can't coach, because that's coaching out there. We look terrible. We look awful.
Meanwhile, team captain Javonte Ball is disappointed in his teammates.
We got to play like we want it. The people who made the field working harder than us. They work way harder than us, man.
In fact, it was really hard work, raising nearly $1 million for this field. And it almost didn't happen. Chris Lambert is CEO of Life Remodeled, the group in charge of an ambitious volunteer makeover of Cody High School and its surrounding neighborhoods. He says a new football field was a priority, but they were $300,000 short on the last day of fundraising.
45 minutes before I get on stage, a family comes up to me and says, do you still need that $300,000? I said, yeah.
Lambert figures they'll want the field named after themselves, the Walrich family, Walrich Field.
They get out a checkbook, they write a $300,000 check, and they say, we want to call it Hope Field.
Anyway, halftime is ending. Maybe it was the stern speeches. Maybe it was this prayer by Reverend Bob Chirac, whose suburban Detroit church has adopted Cody High.
We pray the world would hear that Detroit is rising from the ashes and that stories like Cody would prove that.
Whatever it is, the Cody Comets after halftime are a different team. They quickly score and score again and again. Now, we've all seen those corny movies about the team picking itself up and coming back to win. This is just like that. The Comets end up winning the game 24-0. And just like that, a field named Hope earns its name.
Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton reporting from Cody High School in Detroit. If you want to check out a slideshow, go to our website, michiganradio.org. Welcome back to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. When we talk in Michigan about food insecurity or food deserts, it's usually talk about Detroit, Flint, cities battling poverty. But there is another region where access to healthy, fresh food is a constant challenge, the Upper Peninsula. Take Alger County. It's been classified by the USDA as a low-income, low-access community. That means people have to drive a minimum of 10 miles to get to a fully stocked grocery store. We wanted to look at food insecurity in the UP. John Sherman Jones is co-founder and chair of the Alger Community Food Pantry, and he's with us now. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
And Matt Raven is a professor in the Department of Community Sustainability at Michigan State University. He and his team are developing an incubator farm in Alger County as a way to combat food insecurity. Matt, very good to have you with us.
Yeah, it's great to be here.
John, let me start with you. Give us all an idea of what people in Alger County have to go through to gain access to fresh, nutritious food and a fully stocked grocery store.
I think one thing you have to understand, and it's harder for downstate urban areas to understand that, is we're a very spread out county. I mean, it looks like we were gerrymandered. We've got Grand Marais, which is 60 miles away from Munising. We extend all along Lake Superior. So it's not unusual for people to have to drive 60 miles to a well-stocked grocery store. You know, while they have little stores here and there available, they really don't have a lot of fresh produce, and especially seasonal, a lot of it. So it is tougher for us here, all resources, medical, to travel a long distance for us. So it is a challenge, and I think it's more of a challenge in the winter here where the fresh produce is much more expensive and harder to find.
And have things become more difficult because of the Great Recession? I mean, the state is slowly recovering from this, but, you know, how hard were people in your county hit, and are the effects still being felt?
You know, I keep hearing about the recovery, but it actually our numbers have increased 30% this year over last year. We're finding more and more people coming in here asking for help. And we're finding people who really, you know, never been to the programs that provide help. So we're getting newer people in that we've not seen before.
Matt, what are the, we'll start with the health consequences of having this kind of food insecurity in Upper Peninsula communities. What do you see?
As John was saying, I mean, it is a very rural area, and in addition to being very rural, it's very far north. You know, so you're north of the 45th parallel. In fact, parts of the UP are, you know, the 47th parallel, and so that adds to the complexity of growing what we call nutrient-dense food or healthy, you know, high-quality foods in terms of fruit and vegetables. So you put that together with, you know, having to truck in food from across the bridge or from other parts of the country, it does lead to food insecurity. The UP has lagged behind the rest of the country in terms of economic recovery. I mean, there's still areas of the UP that have nearly 20% unemployment. And so that's one of the things that we want to try to combat, is to leverage the natural resource base of the UP to create new jobs in the role of producing food. So that's a win-win. You put more people to work on the land, and at the same time, you increase the food security of the UP.
Tell us more about this incubator farm that you're developing. You're doing this in Chatham in Alger County?
Correct. Chatham is the location for the Upper Peninsula Research and Extension Center, which is our presence, or Michigan State's presence in the UP. That center is the oldest center in Michigan for what we do in terms of research and extension. We've had a presence at Chatham since 1899, so that's a long time. What we're doing is we're leveraging some of the old original buildings, and through the help of a USDA National Institute for Food and Agriculture grant, we're repurposing that part of the station into an incubator farm to provide resources and training for getting farmers and apprentice farmers to get the skills necessary to transition to their own farms and their own land. One of the big things that's lacking, there are some farmers out there, some beginning farmers, and we have a renewed interest in the younger generation of getting back to the land to kind of have the expertise ready, to have the resources that they might not be able to afford right away, but that we can give to them by leveraging our land, leveraging the equipment we have there to get more experience, get more confidence, and then maybe even build a little bit of capital to move toward their own production units, you know, primarily in the UP. That is our focus.
So when you say incubator farm, do you provide land? You provide training and you also provide land? So
correct.
Okay. What kinds of things are grown? What are they learning and what are they doing with that knowledge?
Well, I mean, we just got the grant this last year. This first summer, we hired a farm manager out of Iowa who's had a lot of experience in local food production, intensive food production, and also season extension. I'm using passive solar greenhouses, or also known as hoop houses. So we've been building the infrastructure this summer, and we've actually repurposed land, and we actually have crops going into Marquette Food Co-op as well as Northern Michigan University, restaurants, and other locales. We are recruiting our first cohort this year. So our first cohort of apprentice farmers will start this following growing season. You know, we'll probably have a cohort to begin with of 3 apprentice farmers, and then it'll be a 2-year program where they'll have a quarter acre of their own land that we'll help with a business plan, a marketing plan. They'll also have space in our hoop house, as well as access to our farm manager and other expertise. For example, one of my colleagues, John Beerbaum, who's a professor of horticulture, who's well known, you know, in the Great Lakes region for, you know, season extension, organic farming, local food production. So, you know, we'll be growing multiple crops. One of the things we want to try to do is show farmers some of the new technologies out there to extend the season in a low-input way.
John Sherman-Jones, how much difference do you hope this makes in your county?
Oh, I think it's a great idea, and I really am all for trying to buy local, fresh, whole foods. For the people we're servicing, it, I'm not sure what the impact's going to be. You know, a lot of people think, well, just go out and grow your own food. But, you know, for a lot of people who are coming in to us for help, they don't have the investment to be able to, you know, do some of that. Maybe the hoop houses will open up some opportunity for them without taking that major investment in tools and supplies. There are a lot of people who get by up here in the UP with, you know, hunting and fishing and in small gardens. But I'm not sure for the low-income population how significant an impact that'll be. I do think if it makes more fresh foods available, that will be a help.
I'm talking with John Sherman-Jones, who's co-founder and chair of the Alger Community Food Pantry, and Matt Raven, who's a professor in the Department of Community Sustainability at Michigan State University, as we look at food insecurity in the Upper Peninsula. And we do hear so much discussion about food insecurity issues in, say, Detroit. Why is it you think we hear so little about the same problems for people in the Upper Peninsula? What do you think, John?
Well, and we don't have the population density, so obviously the impact on the number of people is less. We're spread out a lot more. Also, I think there's a little more ability to be more independent if you live in a rural area. Like I said, people are used to hard winters, but I think it's the age-old problem that we're sparsely populated and we don't get the political attention in densely populated areas.
Is there also kind of a sense of, well, of course, it's the Upper Peninsula, meaning kind of almost expecting that having to drive far distances goes hand in hand with living there, but people who don't live in the Upper Peninsula don't realize what a challenge that can be?
I think that's true. Most Upers kind of accept that. You may have to go 60 miles to find a doctor, 60 miles to find a good grocery store, and plan for it. So we accept that, I guess, to some extent. You know, over the years, we've gotten a little more access to larger stores and that. But on the other hand, you know, I think Upers tend to accept that. Hey, you know, I can go walk on the beach and not see another person for a couple miles. And there's a sense of appreciation for some of that solitude, too. So, yeah, in some sense, we know it's going to be a hard winter. We know what winters are like, and we certainly know what snow is like. And we do accept some of that. But I think it doesn't negate the fact that people do struggle, and people on low income especially struggle to get food and to get fresh produce.
And Matt Raven, that's really the other component we're looking at, apart from just, yes, it's thinly populated because that's the Upper Peninsula. You have this, you know, great impact from the Great Recession and people coping with poverty in a way that is, I think, again, overlooked so often by folks downstate.
Yeah, definitely. And if you look at the UP, it represents 1/3 the landmass of Michigan. But if you look at their population, it's only 3%. You know, and it's interesting, in addition to the economy, is that even though it's a food desert, you know, the UP has severe problems with obesity. You know, so Michigan, and specifically the UP, you know, has the 8th highest rate of obesity in the United States. That's directly related to access to healthy, nutritious food. If we can start solving that problem where we have greater food security, of not only food security, but food justice, you know, I'm a firm believer that you should not have to be wealthy to afford good food. that's another nut that we have to crack. If you can, you know, build the economy, you know, based on natural resources and get good food, you know, locally produced, I think you can solve a lot of, you know, wicked problems at once.
And in a broad picture, it's hard to understand why it is we're sitting here talking about problems with food justice in Michigan when you consider the strength of Michigan's agricultural industry. I mean, aren't we just second only to California in the diversity of the crops that we grow in our state?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, we are a very diverse ag production, and we're only second to California. That's true.
I guess it could be understood in a different way if we were sitting in Arizona having this conversation about problems raising, growing, and getting fresh food to people. But, you know, it just seems on a large scope, we shouldn't have to have this conversation.
A lot of the foods that we're talking about, you know, are being pushed out by, you know, corn and soybeans as well. As we continue to, you know, put more and more acreage into soybeans and corn specifically, especially corn because of ethanol, you see corn being grown further and further north. That changes the complexion of what is grown and who's growing it.
Yeah, good point. John Sherman Jones, actually, I want you both to answer this, but I'm going to start with you, John. What is the biggest change that you hope to see that would help your neighbors in the Upper Peninsula gain better access to healthy food?
Well, one of the concerns I have is the way we count success in food distribution. The USDA, for example, has us do monthly counts of every family we help at the food pantries, and we have to do that for the food banks like Feeding America. And yet the USDA portion of the foods that the food banks get, I mean, only averages 6 to 12%, but they're counting 100% of the people we help. And a lot of the food pantries have to go to grocery stores to, you know, supplement their standard stock. They don't just get it from food banks. More and more of the food bank stuff is purchased and not donated, and we struggle with donated items. So the USDA can look and count every single person we help, but they're actually, from a food bank position, providing 6 to 12% of the food. It seems really misleading. And not only that, there's duplication there. You know, we also, in our area, we get TFAP foods we give out, and we count every family for that. And then we count every family again for the USDA stuff coming from the food banks. And the numbers look great, but they're overlapping. They don't really give us a true sense of how much that food is helping. And, you know, if you've accessed the food bank and gotten USDA stuff one time out of the year, all year round, they're counting everybody you help. It's just a really inaccurate way of counting the impact of the USDA food. We try and concentrate on getting healthy food. We try to look at the big picture. You know, just getting a bunch of junk food out to people looks good in numbers, but it's not really helping them. Like Matt said, the obesity problems there, you know, getting unhealthy food out to people might make the numbers look good, but it's not going to do them a lot of good health-wise. So we're trying to get better quality whole foods, fresh foods as much as we can. We get some donations from one of the local grocery stores we've got set up. We're getting garden donations from Elger Correctional Facilities, fresh produce coming in. We're trying to do the best we can to get quality foods to people. But I think sometimes the numbers don't give a good picture, and it can be very, very misleading, which you don't want to do. It's easy to give out free food. If I had free food and wanted to just give it out, I could give that really fast, and the numbers would look great. And if that's all they're looking at, I would be very successful. But, you know, the Elger Community Food Pantry's philosophy is trying to target the people most in need, when they most need it, and what they can use, keeping in mind nutritional priorities, and making sure that the last in line gets the same as the first in line. And to do it in a discreet and confidential manner to protect their dignity and to make sure we have ample stock to give people something.
As I say, I see in your brochure, you say our resources are limited and our intent is not to create dependency. So it is it's emergency assistance.
And the whole idea of TFAP is temporary emergency assistance. And yet we've kind of created a program where the one who gives out the most gets rewarded the most. And pretty soon their numbers look better. So they're getting more of the supply we used to get, and our numbers dwindle, and we're being punished because we're being more discretionary. And it's just not a good way to count success in food distribution.
Matt Raven, from where your point of view at Michigan State University and in the work you're doing, what's your thought, the biggest change that you want to see that would help get quality food onto tables in the Upper Peninsula?
Well, one of the things that we're really working on is both, you know, research about quality foods and how it's produced, but also education about it. You know, the incubator farm at the North Farm, and that's what we're calling it. We're calling it the North Farm because that's where the original station was located. You know, it's the first step to building an educational, an extension center around the concept of food and how it's produced and its linkages, you know, to healthy communities, to healthy people, and also healthy resources, because it's all connected. You know, we envision having this center that's basically from, you know, cradle to grave, you know, for people. And so we're starting with farmers, you know, beginning farmers, but, you know, we want to work with K through 12 schools. We want to work with two-year schools, four-year schools, and also what we call skill seekers, you know, those people that want to add enterprises to their existing farms or ranches, or those people that are in town that want to, you know, grow some of their own food. And I think that now, more than ever in my life, you know, we're seeing people talk about food again. I'm an old high school ag teacher. We've lost touch with the way our food is produced and the way it's distributed. In the last 5 to 6 years, not only in Michigan, but in the United States, we've seen a renaissance where, once again, people are talking about food, how it's produced, and what's in it. And to me, that's a very big step forward to fixing some of the issues we have with our food system. You know, we want to be able to grow healthy, nutritious food, you know, while improving our environmental resources in an economical way. You know, we're talking about the triple bottom line, where we take care of the economy, we take care of communities, and we take care of the environment. That's really kind of the key to sustainability, and we're looking at it through a food lens. What we're trying to do is position the Upper Peninsula Research and Extension Center to be that focal point for a lot of these efforts, and we want to work with groups that are already in the UP, such as food pantries, the Upper Peninsula Food Exchange, the Marquette Food Co-op, and all the other efforts that are up there. You know, I think sometimes in other parts of the country, you know, you have a lot of organizations that start stepping over each other. And one of our main goals is to make sure that we can work together and have a greater impact on what we're trying to do.
Fighting hunger and seeking food justice in the Upper Peninsula. We've been speaking with Matt Raven, professor in the Department of Community Sustainability at Michigan State University, and John Sherman Jones, who's co-founder and chair of the Alger Community Food Pantry. Thanks so much to both of you for talking with us today on Stateside.
Thank you very
much. Thank you.
50 years ago, Ford gave America the Mustang, and America has loved it ever since.
He wanted the cars to reflect this young, exuberant, can-do America that existed in the 1960s.
We will look at Mustang's past and at its future next time on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Emily Fox, Michelle Hahn, Haley Hirschman, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.